Slujiri de șevă.
44.
52. YT waits so long that she thinks the sun must have come up by now, but she knows it can't really be more than a couple of hours. In a way, it doesn't even matter. Nothing ever changes. The music plays, the cartoon videotape rewinds itself and starts up again, men come in and drink, and try not to get caught staring at her. She might as well be shackled to the table anyway. There's no way she could ever find her way back home from here. So she waits. Suddenly, Raven's standing in front of her. He's wearing different clothes, wet, slippery clothing made out of animal skins or something. His face is red and wet from being outside.
You get your job all done?
Sort of, Raven says. I did enough.
What do you mean, enough?
I mean, I don't like being called out of a date to do bullshit work, Raven says. So I got things in order out there, and my attitude is, let his gnomes worry about the details.
Well, I've been having a great time here.
Sorry, baby. Let's get out of here, he says, speaking with the intense, strained tones of a man with an erection. Let's go to the core, he says, once they get into the cool air above deck.
What's there?
Everything, he says. The people who run this whole place. Most of these people, he waves his hand out over the raft, can't go there. I can. Want to see it?
Sure. Why not? She says, hating herself for sounding like such a sap. But what else is she going to say?
He starts leading her down a long moonlit series of gangplanks, in toward the big ships in the middle of the raft. You can almost skate here, but you'd have to be really good.
Why are you so different from the other people?
YT says. She kind of blurts it out without doing a whole lot of thinking first. But it seems like a good question. He laughs.
I'm an Aleut. I'm different in a lot of ways.
No. I mean, your brain works in a different way, YT says. You're not whacked out. You know what I mean? You haven't mentioned the word all night.
We have a thing we do in kayaks. It's like surfing, Raven says.
Really? I've surfed too. In traffic, YT says.
We don't do this for fun, Raven says. It's part of how we live. We get from island to island by surfing on waves.
Same here, YT says. Except we go from one franchlet to the next by surfing on cars.
See, the world is full of things more powerful than us. But if you know how to catch a ride, you can go places, Raven says.
Right. I'm totally hip to what you're saying.
That's what I'm doing with the Orthos. I agree with some of their religion, but not all of it. But their movement has a lot of power. They have a lot of people and money and ships.
And you're surfing on it.
Yeah.
That's cool. I can relate. What are you trying to do? I mean, what's your real goal?
They're crossing a big, broad platform. Suddenly, he's right behind her. His arms are around her body, and he draws her back into him. Her toes are just barely touching the ground. She can feel his cool nose against her temple and his hot breath coming into one ear. It sends a tingle straight down to her toes.
Short-term goal or long-term goal? Raven whispers.
Long-term.
I used to have this plan. I was going to nuke America.
Oh, well, that'd be kind of harsh, she says.
Maybe. Depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Other than that, no long-term goals.
Every time he whispers something, another breath tickles her ear.
How about medium-term, then?
In a few hours, the raft comes apart, Raven says. We're headed for California, looking for a decent place to live. Some people might try to stop us. It's my job to help the people make it safe and sound up onto the shore. So you might say, I'm going to war.
Oh, that's a shame, she mumbles.
So it's hard to think of anything besides the here and now.
Yeah, I know.
I rented a nice room to spend my last night in, Raven says. It's got clean sheets.
Not for long, she thinks.
She had thought that his lips would be cold and stiff, like a fish. But she's shocked at how warm they are. Every part of his body feels hot, like that's his only way of keeping warm up in the Arctic. About 30 seconds into the kiss, he bends down, wraps his great thigh-sized forearms around her waist, cinches her up into the air, lifting her feet up off the deck. She was afraid he would take her to some horrible place, but it turns out he rented a whole shipping container stacked way up high on one of the container ships in the core. The place is like a luxury hotel for big core wheels. She's trying to decide what to do with her legs, which are now dangling uselessly. She's not quite ready to wrap them around him, not this early in the date. Then she feels them spreading apart, way, way apart. Raven's thighs must be bigger around than his waist. He has lifted one leg up into her crotch and put the foot up on a chair, so she's straddling his thigh. And with his arms, he's holding her body up against him, squeezing and relaxing, so that she's helplessly rocking back and forth, all her weight on her crotch. Some huge muscle, the upmost part of his quadricep, angles up where it attaches to the bone in his pelvis. And as he rocks her in closer and tighter, she ends up straddling that, shoved against it so tight that she can feel the seams in the crotch of her coverall, feel the coins in the key pocket of Raven's black jeans. When he slides his hands downward, still pressing her inward, and squeezes her butt in both hands, so big it must be like squeezing an apricot, fingers so long they wrap around and push up into her crack, and she rocks forward to get away from it, but there's nowhere to go except into his body. Her face breaking away from the kiss and sliding against the perspiration of his broad, smooth, whiskerless neck. She can't help letting out a yelp that turns into a moan, and then she knows he's got her. Because she never makes noises during sex, but this time, she can't help it. And once she's decided that, she's impatient to get on with it. She can move her arms, she can move her legs, but the middle part of her body is pinned in place. It's not going to move until Raven moves it. And he's not going to move it until she makes him want to. So she goes to work on his ear. That usually does it. He tries to get away from her. Raven, trying to run away from something. She likes that idea. She has arms that are as strong as a man's, strong from hanging on to that poon on the freeway. So she wraps them around his head like a vice and presses her forehead against the side of his head and starts orbiting the tip of her tongue around the little folded-over rim of his outer ear. He stands paralyzed for a couple of minutes, breathing shallowly, while she works her way inward. And when she finally shoves her tongue into his ear canal, he bucks and grunts like he's just been harpooned, lifts her up off his leg, kicks the chair across the room so hard it cracks against the steel wall of the shipping container. She feels herself falling backward toward the futon, thinks for a moment she's about to get crushed beneath him. But he catches all the weight on his elbows, except for his lower body, which slams into hers all at once, sending another electric shot of pleasure up her back and down her legs. Her thighs and calves have turned solid and tight, like they've been pumped full of juice. She can't relax them. He leans up on one elbow, separating their bodies for a moment, plants his mouth on hers to maintain the contact, fills her mouth with his tongue, holds her there with it while he one-hands the fastener at the collar of her coverall and yanks the zipper all the way down to the crotch. It's open now, exposing a broad V of skin converging from her shoulders. He rolls back onto her, grabs the top of the coverall with both hands, and pulls it down behind her,
forcing her arms down and to her sides, stuffing the mass of fabric and pads down underneath the small of her back so she stays arched up toward him. Then he's in between her tight thighs, all those skating muscles strained to the limit, and his hands come back inside to squeeze her butt again, this time his hot skin against hers. It's like sitting on a warm buttered griddle. Makes the whole body feel warmer. There's something she's supposed to remember at this point. Something she has to take care of. Something important. One of those dreary duties that always seems so logical when you think about it in the abstract and, at moments like this, seems so utterly beside the point that it never even occurs to you. It must be something to do with birth control, or something like that. But YT is helpless with passion, so she has an excuse. So she squirms and kicks her knees until the coverall and her panties have slid down to her ankles. Raven gets completely naked in about 3 seconds. He pulls his shirt off over his head and throws it somewhere, bucks out of his pants, and kicks them off onto the floor. His skin is as smooth as hers, like the skin of a mammal that swims through the sea, but he feels hot, not cold and fishy. She doesn't see his cock, but she doesn't want to. What's the point, right? She does something she's never done before. Comes as soon as he goes into her. It's like a bolt of lightning shoots out from the middle, down the backs of her tensed legs, up her spine, into her nipples. She sucks in air until her whole rib cage is poking out through the skin and then screams it all out. She just rips one. Raven's probably deaf now, which is his fucking problem. She goes limp. So does he. He must have come at the same time, which is okay. It's early, and poor Raven was horny as a goat from being out to sea. Later on, she'll expect more endurance. Right now, she's content to lie underneath him and suck the warmth out of his body. She's been cold for days. Her feet are still cold, hanging out in the air. But that just makes the rest of her feel much better. Raven seems content too, uncharacteristically so. Talk about bliss. Most guys would already be flipping through channels on the TV. Not Raven. He's content to lie here all night, breathing softly into her neck. As a matter of fact, he's gone to sleep right on top of her, like something a woman would do. She dozes too, lies there for a minute or two, all these thoughts going through her head. This is a pretty nice place. Like a mid-priced business hotel in the valley. She never figured anything like this existed on the raft. But there's rich people and poor people here too, just like anywhere else. When they came to a certain place on the walkway, not far from the first of the big core ships, there was an armed guard blocking the way. He let Raven go on through, and Raven took YT with him, leading her by the hand, and the guard gave her a look, but he didn't say anything. He was keeping most of his attention on Raven. After that, the walkway got a lot nicer. It was broad, like the boardwalk at the beach, and not quite so crowded with old Chinese ladies carrying gigantic bundles on their backs. And it didn't smell like shit quite so much. When they got to the first core ship, there was a stairway that took them from sea level up to its deck. From there, they took a gangplank across to the innards of another ship. And Raven led her through the place like he'd been through it a million times, and eventually they crossed another gangplank into this container ship. And it was just like a fucking hotel in there. Bellhops with white gloves carrying luggage for guys in suits, a registration desk, everything. It was still a ship. Everything's made out of steel that has been painted white a million times over, but nothing like what she expected. There's even a little helipad where the suits can come and go. There's a chopper parked next to it with a logo she's seen before. Rife Advanced Research Enterprises. Rare. The people who gave her the envelope to deliver to EBGOC headquarters. All of this is fitting together now. The feds, and L. Bob Rife, and the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates, and the raft are all part of the same deal. Who the hell are all these people? she asked Raven when she first saw it. But he just shushed her. She asked him again later as they were wandering around looking for their room, and he told her, "These guys all work for L. Bob Reif. Programmers and engineers and communications people. Reif's an important man. Got a monopoly to run." "Reif's here?" she asked him. Putting on an act, of course. She had it figured out by that point. "Shh," he said. "It's a nice piece of intel. Hero should like it, if she can just get it to him. And even that's going to be easy. She never thought there'd be metaverse terminals here on the raft. But on this ship, there's a whole row of them, so that visiting suits can call back to civilization. All she has to do is get to one without waking up Raven. Which could be tricky. It's too bad she couldn't drug him with something, like in the Raft movies." That's when the realization comes. It swims up out of her subconscious in the same way that a nightmare does. Or when you leave the house and remember half an hour later that you left a tea kettle going on the stove. It's a cold, clammy reality that she can't do a damn thing about. She has finally remembered what that nagging thing was that bothered her for a moment, right before the actual moment of fucking. It was not birth control. It was not a hygiene thing. It was her dentata, the last line of personal self-defense. Along with Uncle Enzo's dog tags, the one piece of stuff that the orthos didn't take. They didn't take it because they don't believe in cavity searches. Which means that at the moment Raven entered her, a very small hypodermic needle slipped imperceptibly into the engorged frontal vein of his penis, automatically shooting a cocktail of powerful narcotics and depressants into his bloodstream. Raven's been harpooned in the place where he least expected it. Now he's going to sleep for at least 4 hours. And then, boy, is he ever going to be pissed? Hero remembers Elliot's warning. Don't go onto the raft itself without a local guide. This kid must be a refugee that Bruce Lee recruited from some Filipino neighborhood on the raft. The kid's name is Transubstanciacion, Tranny for short. He climbs into the Zodiac before Hero tells him to. "Wait a sec," Hero says. "We have to do some packing first." Hero risks turning on a small flashlight, uses it to rummage around the yacht, picking up valuable stuff. A few bottles of presumably drinkable water, some food, extra ammunition for his 9. He takes one of the grappling hooks too, coiling its rope neatly. Seems like the kind of thing that might be useful on the raft. He has one other chore to take care of. Not something he's looking forward to. Hero has lived in a lot of places where mice and even rats were a problem. He used to get rid of them using traps. But then he had a run of bad luck with the things. He would hear a trap snap shut in the middle of the night, and then instead of silence, he would hear pitiable squeaking and thrashing, whacking noises as the stricken rodent tried to drag itself back to safety with a trap snapped over some part of its anatomy, usually its head. When you've gotten up at 3 a.m. to find a live mouse on your kitchen counter leaving a contrail of brain tissue across the formica, it is hard to get back to sleep, and so he prefers to set out poison now. Somewhat in the same vein, a severely wounded man, the last man Hero shot, is thrashing around on the deck of the yacht, up near the bow, babbling. More than anything he has ever wanted to do, Hero wants to get into the Zodiac and get away from this person. He knows that in order to go up and help him, or put him out of his misery, he's going to have to shine the flashlight on him, and when he does that, he's going to see something he'll never be able to forget. But he has to do it. He swallows a couple of times because he's already gagging and follows his flashlight beam up to the bow. It's much worse than he had expected. This man apparently took a bullet somewhere around the bridge of his nose, aimed upward. Everything above that point has been pretty much blown off. Hero's looking into a cross-section of his lower brain. Something is sticking up out of his head. Hero figures it must be fragments of skull or something, but it's too smooth and regular for that. Now that he's gotten over his initial nausea, he's finding this easier to look at. It helps to know that the guy is out of his misery. More than half of his brain is gone. He's still talking. His voice sounds whistly and gaseous, like a pipe organ gone bad because of the changes in his skull. But it's just a brainstem function, just a twitch in the vocal cords. The thing sticking up out of his head is a whip antenna about a foot long. It is encased in black rubber, like the antennas on cop walkie-talkies, and it is strapped onto his head above the left ear. This is one of the antenna heads that Elliot warned them about. Hero grabs the antenna and pulls. He might as well take the headset with him. It must have something to do with the way El Bob Reif controls the raft. It doesn't come off. When Hero pulls, what's left of the guy's head twists around, but the antenna doesn't come loose. And that's how Hero figures out that this isn't a headset at all. The antenna has been permanently grafted onto the base of the man's skull. Hero switches his goggles into millimeter wave radar and stares into the man's ruined head. The antenna is attached to the skull by means of short screws that go into the bone, but do not pierce all the way through. The base of the antenna contains a few microchips, whose purpose Hero cannot divine by looking at them. But nowadays, you can put a supercomputer on a single chip, so anytime you see more than one chip together in one place, you're looking at significant wear. A single hair-thin wire emerges from the base of the antenna and penetrates the skull. It passes straight through to the brainstem and then branches and rebranches into a network of invisibly tiny wires embedded in the brain tissue, coiled around the base of the tree. Which explains why this guy continues to pump out a steady stream of raft babble, even when his brain is missing. It looks like El Bob Reif has figured out a way to make electrical contact with the part of the brain where Asherah lives. These words aren't originating here. It's a Pentecostal radio broadcast coming through on his antenna. Reason is still up top, its monitor screen radiating blue static toward heaven. Hero finds the hard power switch and turns it off. Computers this powerful are supposed to shut themselves down after you've asked them to. Turning one off with the hard switch is like lulling someone to sleep by severing their spinal column. But when the system is snow-crashed, it loses even the ability to turn itself off, and primitive methods are required. Hero packs the Gatling gun assembly back into the case and latches it shut. Maybe it's not as heavy as he thought, or maybe he's on adrenaline overdrive. Then he realizes why it seems so much lighter. Most of its weight was ammunition, and Fisheye used up quite a bit. He half carries, half drags it back to the stern, making sure the heat exchanger stays in the water, and somersaults it into the Zodiac. Hero climbs in after it, joining Tranny, and starts attending to the motor.
"No motor," Tranny says. "It snag bad."
Right. The spider web would get wrapped around the propeller. Tranny shows Hero how to snap the Zodiac's oars into the oarlocks. Hero rows for a while and finds himself in a long, clear zone that zigzags its way through the raft, like a lead of clear water between ice floes and the Arctic.
"Motor okay,"
Tranny says. He drops the motor into the water. Tranny pumps up the fuel line and starts it up. It starts on the first pull. Bruce Lee ran a tight ship. As Hero begins to motor down the open space, he is afraid that it is just a little cove in the ghetto. But this is just a trick of the lights. He rounds a corner and finds it stretching out for some distance. It is a sort of beltway that runs all the way around the raft. Small streets and even smaller alleys lead from this beltway into the various ghettos. Through the scope, Hero can see that their entrances are guarded. Anyone's free to cruise around the beltway, but people are more protective of their neighborhoods. The worst thing that can happen on the raft is for your neighborhood to get cut loose. That's why the raft is such a tangled mess. Each neighborhood is afraid that the neighboring hoods are going to gang up on them, cut them loose, leave them to starve in the middle of the Pacific. So they are constantly finding new ways to tie themselves into each other,
running cables over, under, and around their neighbors, tying into more far-flung hoods, or preferably into one of the core ships. The neighborhood guards are armed, needless to say. Looks like the weapon of choice is a small Chinese knockoff of the AK-47. Its metal frame jumps out pretty clearly on radar. The Chinese government must have stamped out an unimaginable number of these things back in the days when they spent a lot of time thinking about the possibility of fighting a land war with the Soviets. Most of them just look like indolent third-world militia the world over. But at the entrance to one neighborhood, Hiro sees that the guard in charge has a whip antenna sticking straight up in the air, sprouting from his head. A few minutes later, they get to a point where the beltway is intersected by a broad street that runs straight into the middle of the raft, where the big ships are, the core. The closest one is a Nipponese container ship, a low flat deck number with a high bridge, stacked with steel shipping containers. It's webbed over with rope ladders and makeshift stairways that enable people to climb up into this container or that. Many of the containers have lights burning in them.
"Apartment building," Tranny jokes, noting Hiro's interest.
Then he shakes his head and rolls his eyes and rubs his thumb against his fingertips. Apparently, this is quite the swell neighborhood. The nice part of the cruise comes to an end when they notice several fast skiffs emerging from a dark and smoky neighborhood.
"Vietnam gang," Tranny says.
He puts his hand on Hiro's and gently but firmly removes it from the outboard motor's throttle. Hiro checks them out on radar. A couple of these guys have the little AK-47s, but most of them are armed with knives and pistols, obviously looking forward to some close-up face-to-face contact. These guys in the boats are, of course, the peons. More important-looking gents stand along the edge of the neighborhood, smoking and watching. A couple of them are wireheads. Tranny revs it up, turns into a sparse neighborhood of loosely connected Arabian dhows, and maneuvers through the darkness for a while, occasionally putting his hand on Hiro's head and gently pressing it down so he doesn't catch a rope with his neck. When they emerge from the fleet of dhows, the Vietnamese gang is no longer in evidence. If this happened in daylight, the gangsters could track them by following Reason's steam. Tranny steers them across a medium-sized street and into a cluster of fishing boats. In the middle of this area, an old trawler sits, being cut up for scrap, cutting torches illuminating the black surface of the water all around. But most of the work is being done with hammers and cold chisels, which radiate appalling noise across the flat, echoing water. "Home," Tranny says, smiling, and points to a couple of houseboats lashed together. Lights are still burning here. A couple of guys are out on the deck smoking fat makeshift cigars. Through the windows, they can see a couple of women working in the kitchen. As they approach, the guys on the deck sit up, take notice, draw revolvers out of their waistbands. But then Tranny speaks up in a happy stream of Tagalog, and everything changes. Tranny gets the full prodigal son welcome. Crying, hysterical fat ladies, a swarm of little kids piling out of their hammocks, sucking their thumbs and jumping up and down. Older men beaming, showing great gaps and black splotches in their smiles, watching and nodding and diving in to give him the occasional hug. And on the edge of the mob, way back in the darkness, is another wirehead.
"You come in too,"
says one of the women, a lady in her 40s named Eunice.
"That's okay," Hiro says. "I won't intrude."
This statement is translated and moves like a wave through the some 896 Filipinos who have now converged on the area. It is greeted with the utmost shock. "Intrude? Unthinkable! Nonsense! How dare you so insult us?" One of the gap-toothed guys, a miniature old man and probable World War II veteran, jumps onto the rocking Zodiac, sticks to the floor like a gecko, wraps his arm around Hiro's shoulders, and pokes a spliff into his mouth. He looks like a solid guy. Hiro leans into him.
"Compadre, who is the guy with the antenna? A friend of yours?"
"Nah," the guy whispers. "He's an asshole."
Then he puts his index finger dramatically to his lips and shushes.
Amalagin sa bandam kanukari
asusin. 54.
It's all in the eyes. Along with picking handcuffs, vaulting jersey barriers, and fending off perverts, it is one of the quintessential courier skills. Walking around in a place where you don't belong without attracting suspicion. And you do it by not looking at anyone. Keep those eyes straight ahead no matter what. Don't open them too wide. Don't look tense. That, and the fact that she just came in here with a guy that everyone is scared of, gets her back through the container ship to the reception area. I need to use a street terminal, she says to the reception guy. Can you charge it to my room?
Yes, ma'am, the reception guy says.
He doesn't have to ask which room she's in. He's all smiles, all respect. Not the kind of thing you get very often when you're a courier. She could really get to like this relationship with Raven, if it weren't for the fact that he's a homicidal mutant. Hiro ducks out of Tranny's celebratory dinner rather early, drags Reason off the Zodiac and onto the front porch of the houseboat, opens it up, and jacks his personal computer into its BIOS. Reason reboots with no problems. That's to be expected. It's also to be expected that later, probably when he most needs Reason to work, it will crash again, the way it did for Fisheye. He could keep turning it off and on every time it does this, but this is awkward in the heat of battle, and not the type of solution that hackers admire. It would be much more sensible just to debug it, which he could do by hand if he had time. But there may be a better way of going about it. It's possible that by now, Ing Security Industries has fixed the bug, come out with a new version of the software. If so, he should be able to get a copy of it on the street. Hiro materializes in his office. The librarian pokes his head out of the next room, just in case Hiro has any questions for him.
What does Ultima Ratio Regum mean?
The last argument of kings, the librarian says. King Louis XIV had it stamped onto the barrels of all the cannons that were forged during his reign. Hiro stands up and walks out into his garden. His motorcycle is waiting for him on the gravel path that leads to the gate. Looking up over the fence, Hiro can see the lights of downtown rising in the distance again. His computer has succeeded in jacking into L. Bob Reif's global network. He has access to the street. This is as Hiro had expected. Reif must have a whole suite of satellite uplinks there on the Enterprise, patched into a cellular network covering the raft. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to reach the metaverse from his very own watery fortress, which would never do for a man like Reif. Hiro climbs on his bike, eases it through the neighborhood and onto the street, and then gooses it up to a few hundred miles an hour, slaloming between the stanchions of the monorail, practicing. He runs into a few of them and stops, but that's to be expected. Ing Security Industries has a whole floor of a mile-high neon skyscraper near Port 1, right in the middle of downtown. Like everything else in the metaverse, it's open 24 hours because it's always business hours somewhere in the world. Hiro leaves his bike on the street, takes the elevator up to the 397th floor, and comes face-to-face with a receptionist demon. For a moment, he can't peg her racial background. Then he realizes that this demon is half black, half Asian, just like him. If a white man had stepped off the elevator, she probably would have been a blonde. A Nipponese businessman would have come face to face with a perky Nipponese office girl.
Yes, sir, she says. Is this in regard to sales or customer service?
Customer service.
Whom are you with?
You name it, I'm with them.
I'm sorry.
Like human receptionists, the demon is especially bad at handling irony.
At the moment, I think I'm working for the Central Intelligence Corporation, the Mafia, and Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
I see, says the receptionist, making a note.
Also like a human receptionist, it is not possible to impress her.
And what product is this in regards to?
Reason,
Sir, welcome to Ing Security Industries,
says another voice. It is another demon, an attractive black Asian woman in highly professional dress who has materialized from the depths of the office suite. She ushers Hiro down a long, nicely paneled hallway, down another long paneled hallway, and then down a long paneled hallway. Every few steps, he passes by a reception area where avatars from all over the world sit in chairs passing the time. But Hiro doesn't have to wait. She ushers him straight into a nice big paneled office where an Asian man sits behind a desk littered with models of helicopters. It is Mr. Ing himself. He stands up. They swap bows. The usher lady checks out.
You working with Fisheye?
Ing says, lighting up a cig. The smoke swirls in the air ostentatiously. It takes as much computing power realistically to model the smoke coming out of Ing's mouth as it does to model the weather system of the entire planet.
He's dead, Hiro says. Reason crashed at a critical juncture, and he ate a harpoon.
Ing doesn't react. Instead, he just sits there motionless for a few seconds, absorbing this data, as if his customers get harpooned all the time. He's probably got a mental database of everyone who has ever used one of his toys and what happened to them.
I told him it was a beta version, Ing says, and he should have known not to use it for infighting. A $2 switchblade would have served him better.
Agreed. But he was quite taken with it.
Ing blows out more smoke, thinking,
as we learned in Vietnam, high-powered weapons are so sensorily overwhelming that they are similar to psychoactive drugs. Like LSD, which can convince people they can fly, causing them to jump out of windows. Weapons can make people overconfident, skewing their tactical judgment, as in the case of Fisheye.
I'll be sure and remember that, Hiro says.
What kind of combat environment do you want to use Reason in?
Ing says.
I need to take over an aircraft carrier tomorrow morning.
The Enterprise?
Yes.
You know,
Ing says, apparently in a conversational mood,
there's a guy who actually took over a nuclear missile submarine armed with nothing more than a piece of glass.
Yeah, that's the guy who killed Fisheye. I might have to tangle with him, too.
Ing laughs.
What is your ultimate objective? As you know, we are all in this together, so you may share your thoughts with me.
I'd prefer a little more discretion in this case.
Too late for that, Hiro, says another voice.
Hiro turns around. It is Uncle Enzo being ushered through the door by the receptionist, a striking Italian woman. Just a few paces behind him is a small Asian businessman and an Asian receptionist.
I took the liberty of calling them in when you arrived, Ing says, so that we could have a powwow. Pleasure,
Uncle Enzo says, bowing slightly to Hiro. Hiro bows back.
I'm really sorry about the car, sir.
It's forgotten, Uncle Enzo says.
The small Asian man has now come into the room. Hiro finally recognizes him. It is the photo that is on the wall of every Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong in the world. Introductions and bows all around. Suddenly, a number of extra chairs have materialized in the office, so everyone pulls one up. Ing comes out from behind his desk, and they sit in a circle.
Let's cut to the chase, since I assume that your situation, Hiro, may be more precarious than ours,
Uncle Enzo says.
You got that right, sir.
We would all like to know what the hell is going on, Mr. Lee says.
His English is almost devoid of a Chinese accent. Clearly his cute, daffy public image is just a front.
How much of this have you guys figured out so far?
Bits and pieces, Uncle Enzo says. How much have you figured out?
Almost all of it, Hiro says. Once I talk to Juanita, I'll have the rest.
In that case, you are in possession of some very valuable intel, Uncle Enzo says.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a hypercard and hands it toward Hiro. It says, 25 million Hong Kong dollars. Hiro reaches out and takes the card. Somewhere on Earth, two computers swap bursts of electronic noise and the money gets transferred from the Mafia's account to Hiro's.
You'll take care of the split with YT,
Uncle Enzo says. Hiro nods. You bet I will.